Thanks, everyone. Can everybody hear me? I have a terrible projection problem. My kids tell me I have no inside voice, so I don't want to blow anybody's eardrums out. Anyway, thanks for coming. My name is Nancy Basil-Chuck, and I am a freelancer, and I live in Norway, which is partly how I got to be interested in this larger issue of how the Atlantic Ocean works and how people who produce the information, the scientists and the policymakers who work with the information, what they know and what they can tell us about what the future will look like in terms of ocean circulation, climate change, and how that will affect everything from southern Florida to the world at large. When I started writing about the Atlantic ocean circulation, one of the most interesting facts I learned was that the Atlantic Ocean on average is responsible for transferring about 25% of all the sort of heat energy on the planet. That maybe you guys will correct me, that's what I understood. But so it's pretty important in driving what's going to happen with future climate, and we'll be hearing more about that as we go on. Just a few ground rules before we get started. I've asked everybody, because this is a pretty complex issue, I've asked everyone to prepare pretty slides to help describe ocean circulation and make sure we're all up to speed. So a lot of sessions don't have PowerPoint presentations. We will, but they will be short. We'll have a brief statement from each of the speakers, who I will introduce in a second, and then I will ask a couple of moderator questions, and then I'm going to open the floor to all of you. We are recording this session, so I will, or whoever is asked a question, will repeat the question, so it will be on the tape. And as is the case, it looks like most of the people here are full SEJ members, but journalists have priority in these sessions. And also, when you ask a question, I would like you to identify yourself and your affiliation. I guess we'll repeat that for the tape. Okay, we'll try to do that anyway. Hopefully we won't mangle anybody's names. Okay. Without further ado, I'll introduce the panelists, and then we're going to start with, I'll introduce Chris first. This is Chris Mayen. He's an oceanographer with the Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory with NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. To his right, I have Igor Kamakovich. He's an associate professor at the University of Division of Meteorological and Physical Oceanography in their Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. To my near left is the other Nancy Gassman, and she is Natural Resources Administrator and Representative on the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which is in the Natural Resources Planning and Management Division for Broward County. And to her left and my far left is Susan Skemp. She is Executive Director of the Southeast National Marine Renewable Energy Center, which is in the College of Engineering and Computer Science at Florida Atlantic University. Okay, so Chris, take it away. Go ahead. You guys can move if you want. Do you want to move over there?
All right, thank you very much. I will try and be very, very brief to move us along to get to the questions. I'm an oceanographer at NOAA, and I want to stress that everything that I'm going to talk about today is in collaboration with a lot of different folks at the University of Miami and other institutions around the world. Nobody does this kind of thing alone. So what is ocean circulation, just to get started? This is probably too basic for many of you in the room, but I don't want to leave anybody behind. Ocean circulation, people have been studying this for a couple hundred years. This has gotten so well known now that we actually see it in Encyclopedia Britannica. We have a really good idea of what the ocean circulation looks like. You've got ocean currents moving around all over the place, forced by the winds of patterns around the world. This isn't really very real, however. It gets a lot more complicated than that. This is the what's called the meridional overturning circulation. It's a cartoon. Please don't take this to be that the currents are actually exactly where this is. This is kind of on top of or underneath or combined with the wind-driven circulation in that map we just saw before. So here you see all of the red lines and arrows are surface currents. The greens and yellows are waters that are headed from the surface down to depth, and the blue lines and the purple lines are deep ocean currents moving around. I'm going to focus real tightly right now on that location right here in the Atlantic, because that's an area where I and quite a number of my colleagues have been working on measuring the meridional overturning circulation, and so we'll talk a little bit about that, and I'm happy to answer more questions about it as we go. So this is kind of a cautionary tale. Many of you may remember about 6 years ago, there was a lot of stories in the press about this MOC was shutting down. You know, it was all part of the day after tomorrow in the I hesitate to say silly movie, but it was to a certain extent. And it was a lot of this, the press was based on a paper by Harry Bryden and a couple of his colleagues in Nature that looked at five sections from ship measurements over the course of 50 years and saw some indication, if you drew a line through that, that there was this downward trend and that the meridional overturning circulation was slowing down by 30%. Lots of press. I'll show you in a few minutes why that wasn't a good thing. So in around 2004, these three different groups, the University of Miami, NOAA, and the National Oceanography Center in the United Kingdom, got together to build a big array of moorings all the way across the Atlantic. It was based partially at least on the fact that there had been long-term measurements in the Straits of Florida and offshore the Bahamas by NOAA going way back into the 1980s, long before I was there, of course. But essentially a series of different kinds of moorings. I'm not going to explain in detail what the moorings are, but I'm happy to answer questions about them. All the way across that essentially give us a method to measure the transport from the surface to the bottom, all the way across the basin as it's going north or south across the line. So if we throw that on top, if we throw the time series of data we've collected from that on top of that figure I just showed you, that's the blue line over here. And the first thing you notice is that this downward trend doesn't go through that blue data, as in fact the blue data is all much higher than that blue line, or than the trend indicated. And if you look carefully, you'll notice that the values, the five values from the five stars, all were observed at some point or another during this five-year time period, which is basically indicating that this could be just happened to be a high day in that time period a couple of years ago in the 1950s when they did this, and has nothing to do with the trend at all. So we have to be really careful when speculative papers come out. Nature and science are all about speculative papers, but you have to be a little careful running with them, because more often than not, you end up with things that prove to be incomplete, if not inaccurate. So we use a whole range of different instruments. It's a big endeavor. This is really all I wanted to talk to you about so far, but I'm happy to answer questions. And this is just a range of photos of different kinds of things that we use for doing these moorings, different instruments that we're doing. So I'll hand off to Igor, who's going to tell you a little bit about what some of it means.
I will talk about the modeling of ocean circulation and what are the importance of this process and what are the challenges. Okay, just a little bit about my own research. I study ocean circulation, trying to understand the physics involved in the movement of water in the Atlantic and other parts of the ocean. And for this, I use a variety of models. And there are different models that are available, starting from the most sophisticated models that are run at big oceanographic centers, involving many people, huge computer resources, lots of effort. And for scientists like myself, this, the outputs from models like this are available for our analysis, and we can spend time trying to understand the processes that are taking place in these simulations, and for, or we can build our own simpler models, more idealized versions that are focused on a specific process or on a specific part of the ocean. For example, if you want to understand what's going on in this part of the Pacific Ocean, you can build a model like this and simulate oceanic currents. Look a little bit disgusting on this picture, but this is a simple version of the ocean circulation. So today I'm going to briefly talk about just one part, about one mode of ocean circulation that is probably the major, the most important mode of circulation in the Atlantic, so-called the Great Conveyor Belt. You're probably familiar with pictures like this. This is a much simpler version from the picture Chris showed. So it shows just two essential elements of this branch of circulation. The sinking branch, it's an overturning circulation. So water sinks in the North Atlantic, where the waters are cold and salty, saline, and therefore very dense. So these dense waters sink all the way to the surface, and eventually they find their way up, so they rise in other parts of the domain. So there is a sinking branch and a rising branch of this circulation. And the sinking branch of circulation in the North Atlantic is quite vulnerable to climate change because it's controlled by a pretty delicate balance between temperature and salinity, and it's very easy to tip this balance. And if you do, the whole conveyor belt can get disrupted or even shut down completely. And in a warming climate, in the climate that we experience these days, there are two processes that are going on. The surface is getting warmer, which makes the water lighter, and the surface of the ocean in the North Atlantic is also getting fresher because there is more rain and snow, just because the atmosphere contains more moisture, and also because we have a significant melting of ice. When ice melts, it put a lot of fresh water into the ocean, and in the North Atlantic, it will mean that the sinking branch can get less dense and weaker. And scientists actually believe that a long time ago, right after the last ice age, when there was a massive melting of ice and armadas of icebergs leaving the Hudson Bay and entering North Atlantic, this conveyor belt, this overturning circulation, was actually shut down. So the changes in this conveyor belt are possible, and scientists do believe that they took place, actually, a long time ago, but it was real. So why do we care about this branch of circulation? Just a little bit of background. It's an important player in the climate because it delivers heat to the northern part of the Atlantic. The warm water moves northward, cold water returns southward, so the net effect is to warm the North Atlantic. Right? In addition, this branch of circulation redistributes carbon in the ocean. You know that the changing climate is believed to be caused by the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is one of the most important gases, and ocean can actually store and redistribute a significant part of carbon. And if you look at this plot, there is a lot of carbon, man-made carbon, stored in the North Atlantic. Again, this storage is due to the sinking branch of North Atlantic of this conveyor belt. And in addition, and it's particularly important for the South Florida, this branch of circulation can actually affect the sea level. Because currently the sea level is rising, which is scary for us people living in South Florida because we are so flat here. Okay, and this rise is primarily due to the warming of the ocean, not to the melt of land ice. But because the ocean is getting warmer, the warm objects expand and the sea level goes up. And this conveyor belt plays a big role in heating the deep ocean. So it's another important piece. So, very briefly, what can we expect if this conveyor belt gets weaker or is completely shut down? Well, there are two schools of thought among scientists. Some scientists will say that it can cause the next ice age, and it actually did happen. Some scientists believe that it did happen a long time ago, right after the last ice age. The Earth was recovering from these extreme cold conditions of the ice age, but then this recovery was interrupted abruptly. And some scientists will say that it was due to the shutdown of the conveyor belt. Those melting icebergs destroyed the conveyor belt, and as a result, boom, the Earth went back to the ice age condition. Well, some scientists are more cautious. They say, well, yes, this conveyor belt does warm Europe, but the effect is not that large. You're not talking about, even if you stop this mode of circulation completely, we're not talking about the ice age or anything dramatic. Things will get colder, but we will probably not notice. So how to sort this out? Well, the answer is easy. You should take a numerical model, run it for 100 years, and see what happens. Well, it was done many times, and this is one of the latest attempts. There are several models taken from the report by Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the most influential international body on climate. And as you can see, they, to put it shortly, they do not agree. The predictions are all over the place. And it looks pretty embarrassing. Why is it so difficult for these biggest climate centers, for the brightest people in the field, to capture, to predict these changes more accurately? Well, the climate system is extremely complex. It involves atmosphere, ocean, land, ice, biosphere, geological systems. It's an extremely complicated system, and interactions between components play an important role in shaping the climate of the future. And if you focus just on the ocean, the picture that I showed you before, in reality, is actually much more complicated, as Chris pointed out. And this is just another view on the global overturning, global conveyor belt. And this is the Atlantic Ocean. But other oceans are also important. And in particular, the ocean around Antarctica, the Southern Ocean, plays a big role. And part of my study is focused on the Southern Ocean, trying to understand why it's so important in climate. The second, the biggest limiting issue in the ocean modeling is resolution. Well, numerical models operate with those so-called grid cells. So they divide the world into boxes. The boxes talk to each other. And the smaller the box, the more expensive it is to run the model, but the more accurate the model is. And we've made quite a progress in this direction, coming from the earlier versions. This is Europe in one of the earlier models. You can hardly recognize it. But eventually we came to a resolution that is much, much better than the original one. But this at least you can see the European continent pretty well, but even this resolution in the climate model is not enough to resolve many important currents. And in particular, and this is a part of my research as well, the currents that are called eddies, the analog of atmospheric storms in the ocean. And these currents have a size of 10 to 100 kilometers, and they cannot be resolved by these climate models. But at the same time, they play an important role in the circulation. So this is perhaps why the climate models are not converging on their predictions of the climate. So what do we need to do? We need to improve models, but most importantly, I think from my point of view, we need to understand the physics, the actual processes involved in climate, because every time you make an advance in our understanding of these processes, our accuracy of our predictions improve dramatically. So this is something that me and my colleagues are trying to do: improve understanding of physics, improve understanding of how the climate works, and of course, increase in computer power will help a lot as well. So I would be happy to answer any questions.
We'll take questions at the end. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you've heard a little bit about the background of how the Atlantic Ocean works and how scientists are collecting information. Now we've got Nancy and Sue to talk about putting this information to work in a public policy context.
Yeah, so what you've heard is that sea level rise and the ocean circulation is very, very complicated. How do you take something so complicated and break it down so that an elected official can understand it and make decisions based on that information? And that's a little bit of what I'm going to try to explain to you today. South Florida is a peninsula. It is completely surrounded by the sea. And the premise of this discussion today is about this movie where overnight the world changes how it is. And in a geologic time frame in the next 100 years, John Overpeck at the University of Arizona imagines that by the end of the century, this is what South Florida will look like, where the reds and the oranges represent inundation by the ocean. And if you're not familiar with that, with South Florida, the area of that bright red is the Everglades ecosystem. This is the Florida Keys. Miami is right in here, and most of this is Miami and Broward County, which is who I represent. So sea level rise has significant implications for us in South Florida. Saltwater intrusion, is it going to be a problem for our drinking water source? We already have a lot of challenges related to drainage and flood control because we are so flat. Most people move water by gravity to get it off the land. We would have to pump it to move it around. There are going to be impacts to public and private infrastructure in these low-lying areas. Beach erosion is a major concern, and if you consider the base of our economy here is tourism, that could be a very, very big concern for us. In addition, we have the only coral reef in the continental United States that's also imperiled by sea level rise and climate change, as well as, again, a unique ecosystem in the world, the Everglades ecosystem. And sea level rise has impacts for all of those different areas. So recognizing that from a policy standpoint, South Florida is vulnerable and that we need to do something about it, Broward County with the other counties in the region organized a leadership summit surrounded on climate with our target audience being elected officials. And the result of that summit just 2 years ago was the creation of a coalition of those four different compact counties in the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact. And the language of the compact laid out a few critical things. One was that we needed to collaborate on policy. We needed to have the same technical baseline because we were all using slightly different pictures of what the world was going to look like. We needed to develop a regional climate change action plan, and we needed to hold annual summits to find out what were the advances in the science, what were the changes in the policy, and how were we going to take that information from a local standpoint and move it forward. And so we've got together a series of scientists who had made a variety of different sea level rise projections for South Florida. And the very first slide that Igor showed where he had all those pretty colors and it was the world, that was sea surface height. And the idea that the height of the ocean is different in different locations is not something that most people realize. And so you have to understand your projection for sea level rise from a local standpoint, because sea level rise is a local phenomenon that can be averaged over the globe. And that's an important concept to grasp. So in this lower right-hand, left-hand corner, what you see is this is the tide record for the city of Key West. It's one of the longest records that we have in the continental United States. And what you see is that what started out at the beginning of the last century translates to about 8 to 10 inches of sea level rise in the last 100 years. And if you go ahead and project that out for the next 50 or 60 years, what we see is we're going to get about half a foot of sea level rise in the next 50 years if the trend from the last century persists. But the IPCC and the current scientific thought is that, in fact, that's not going to be the case, that sea level rise is going to accelerate. And so working with a variety of agencies and members of the academic institutions that have an understanding of sea level rise, the compact said for our four counties for the next few years, these are going to be the projections that we're going to use to understand and plan for sea level rise. So 3 to 7 inches by the year 2030, and 9 to 24 inches by the year 2060. And this is important for two reasons. Number one, you need to understand the magnitude of sea level rise in order to start planning for it, and you need to understand the timeline for it. And so because of that, we have a timeline so that we have an understanding of that when we're going to see a one-foot level rise, a two-foot sea level rise, and a three-foot sea level rise. And we use those scenarios to try to understand what our vulnerabilities are in our area. This is a map of Broward County. The Everglades ecosystem is over here. Miami-Dade is down here. And what you see are an inundation map which highlights possible and more likely inundation. And the inundation in this case is defined as elevations that will be below the mean high tide at a one-foot sea level rise. And so you can see that there are areas in Broward County, and by the way, this is the airport, this is the port, and this is downtown Fort Lauderdale. But what happens with that first level of sea level rise, or one-foot sea level rise, which could happen as soon as 2040, is that the majority of these areas are either coastal wetlands or conservation areas. And this is true across all four counties, that those vulnerabilities are more impactful to our natural systems than they are to our human systems. When you go up to 2 feet, again, you see a lot more purple, and this starts to highlight those areas that we need to take quick action to start adapting. And there is a new Florida law which defines something called adaptation action areas, which are areas that will be impacted by either sea level rise or coastal flooding that need an influx of funding now in order to put the infrastructure in place to maintain and protect existing infrastructure. And then our three-foot rise, which could happen based on our projections somewhere between 2075 and 2150, further illustrate areas that are going to be impacted by the tides. But now we start seeing much further inland that we have these areas that are below sea level, but that are most likely going to be impacted because they're not going to be able to drain salt, stormwater and rainwater off. And I'm going to go through this slide very quickly. Basically, the way our drainage system works is water falls off the land, goes through a storm grate, and through gravity drains out to the sea either through a seawall or a canal. But under extreme high tides or high sea level, suddenly the capacity in the system that was taken up by the fresh water coming off the land is no longer available. And so our stormwater systems are holding seawater instead of allowing fresh water to come off the land. And so that could be a significant problem but in the future, but the problem is we're experiencing this now. Every fall in September, October, and November, there are these things called perigean tides, and the average high tide ends up coming up about 8 to 10 inches above what it normally would be. This is an area in Fort Lauderdale. You can see we've got brand new construction and a beautiful home, and here's one of those storm drains. And during these experiences of high tide, what we now see is that this new home that's being under construction is inundated for a period of 2 to 3 days for about 2 or 3 hours per day for a week in October, November, and December. And so these are examples of this is what sea level rise will look like. And you get to look at it 3 days in October because you live in an area that gets inundated. But this tells you what permanent sea level rise will look like in these locations. And here's another example, average tidal state. And this is under these extreme high tides. But in this case, the water didn't come up through the storm drain. It came right over the seawall. And the next extreme high tide is next week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So if you're interested in this concept, here it comes. So what can we do about it in terms of developing policy? Well, the first thing is to support this idea of implementing the adaptation action areas, identifying those areas that are a concern, determining what infrastructure is at risk, what kinds of things can we do to maximize the useful life of that existing infrastructure and property, and then to make sure that in the future, those areas that are particularly vulnerable are not areas where we densify our land uses or invest in a lot of public infrastructure, because those are areas significantly at risk. And I had mentioned that we're going to have a regional climate action plan. That action plan is going to be unveiled and presented at the next climate summit, which is in Key Largo on December 8th and 9th. I believe the event is going to be free, but there'll be a lot of discussion about climate and climate issues there and what Southeast Florida is going to do in terms of their five-year plan to deal with it from a regional standpoint. So that's the end of my discussion. I believe Igor.
Technology is great, but if you have systems that don't talk to each other, you've got a newer version of the software. Let's see if this is
good. That looks good.
Okay. Come on.
Yeah.
There we go. Good.
Magic.
Magic. I'm not an electrical engineer. I'm a mechanical engineer, so stay up to speed with as much as I can on computers, but not always most adept. I'm going to follow on to the first three speakers and talk a little bit about the actual adaptation to bringing renewable energy on board, but using a lot of what the scientists are doing in oceanographic research, in ecosystem research, and bring it together along with policy into a system. And what we're doing in Florida is three years ago, then Governor Crist and the legislature agreed to fund heavily the emphasis on renewable energy at the universities and the state university system. And so we were established at that time as a Center for Ocean Energy Technology. Since then, we've actually gotten a designation, one of three national centers on marine renewable energy, the other two being in the Northwest, Hawaii being the third, the Northwest being Oregon State and the University of Washington. And we're each focusing our research areas on what's locally accessible as far as the resource. So whereas the others are doing wave and tidal and ocean thermal, we're focusing in South Florida on ocean thermal energy conversion. I'll talk about that briefly, and marine hydrokinetic or the force of the Gulf Stream. Florida itself is heavily reliant on fossil fuel. Somewhere between 76% and 80% rely on fossil fuel, and it's almost equally split between energy and then automotive, et cetera, people moving. And the rest of it is for other reasons. It's about 16% nuclear right now, and a very small part of it is renewable or other alternatives. We have looked at the two aspects you'll see on the upper right-hand corner, and this hopefully works, yes. The current itself, the Florida current itself, and then also from that current go back to ocean thermal or the surface and actually the deep water temperatures and using that as a means of conversion to energy. So we're focusing on both of those areas, more prominently on the marine hydrokinetic because that's nearer term. But the questions that get asked to us many times are, can this be done safely and sustainably? What about the Gulf Stream itself? Will it be affected and how will it be affected? And then what are the ecosystem impacts or the marine system impacts? And I would like to say what are the effects because they can, depending on the system you're looking at, be both positive and negative. Okay. This will give you a little bit better aspect of the Florida current. And by the way, the Florida current, about 20% of the Gulf Stream flows between Florida and the Bahamas and the outer islands there. And the rest of it flows east of the system and then reforms north of the island area. This is an acoustic Doppler current profiler that was in the water at a depth of about 600 meters. It was in the current And it was measuring mostly the current speeds. But over a 13-month period of time, the variability, these colors reflect the actual speed of the current. And then if you look at this as an east-west cross-section at one point, it'll give you the what the bottom surface looks like and the Florida Straits. Keep this particular point in mind because this is at about 250 meters, and then this goes down to about 700 meters. And then further, if you go upstream further, you actually get some even deeper areas. But one point to make here is that initial evaluation says that there's possibly about 200 gigawatts of power potential out of the Florida current. And if you look at maybe a recovery of about 5%, 2 to 5%, you're talking about an equivalent, if you know anything about Turkey Point, which is a nuclear power system, power station, this is about the equivalent of 3 Turkey Points. Florida's use of energy is about 5x a Turkey Point. So even at an amount of, say, 500 or 5%, that's a significant potential. It also says that maybe reliance on fossil fuel for Florida can change in the future. And whereas Florida is an importer of oil and gas, and they have to import it all either by ship, pipelines, et cetera, they can start being an exporter of energy at times when they don't need that amount of energy. This is also what's important about this. This is 24/7. So the Florida current itself can be looked at as 24/7 potential, and that means also it's close to a base load power. I mentioned about ocean thermal. The maps that were done probably in the 70s and 80s for ocean thermal energy potential were drawn from readings of the temperature at depths of about 1,000 meters. And it showed Florida had very little potential at all. Well, later information that we have shows that even as shallow as, and you remember that shelf I showed you? That's off of Fort Lauderdale. That's closer to shore. Even at depths that are somewhere between 200 and 250 meters, you're seeing a potential that's required to make this feasible of about 20 degrees Celsius. And that's on average. It's a little bit less in the wintertime, a lot more in the summer. But it says off of Florida, there is a significant potential. And again, somewhere around 200 gigawatts, different type of system for extracting energy, but the recovery amounts also are uncertain at this time. And we're doing the investigation both on where the best potential is or feasibility for that temperature differential and how sustainable is it. And we've been doing what are called CTD casts, conductivity, temperature, and salinity. And those we've been doing over weekly casts out in this area, and we're seeing repeatability. There is a variation seasonally, but it appears to be repeatable from one year to another. Okay, now that's just the resource. If you look at the ecosystem, we've got a number of systems out there that we have to be aware of and protecting and finding solutions that are balanced, informed solutions. We've got in Florida, the sea turtles are an endangered species. We have to be cognizant of that. We know a lot about what's happening along the coastline, very little about their migratory patterns and their distributions once they get off of the coastline. So we're doing a lot of work in that area. There's a new area called a CHAPC, coral habitat area of particular concern. It's been designated as such. And so that's another area that there's very little information known about. And there's not a whole lot in the way of surveys, but we're conducting the surveys right now in certain areas of our interest to make sure that when we go into the
actual anchoring mode for this total research program, that we're cognizant of where the confluence is. And we're seeing that this is more further to the east of where we are, because there are greater escarpments and better area for the corals to inhabit. We're also doing some of the work, and this, I don't have a moving picture here, but to see what happens if you extract, say, a minimal amount of energy from the Gulf Stream. What are the effects on the Gulf Stream further up along the coastline? And initially, we're seeing that there's not much difference from what you would see through normal behavior of the Gulf Stream. So further investigation, further work across the universities is going to be really paramount, especially in the area and the section that we want to be concerned about, which is in a more of a mesoscale rather than the macro scale of what's happening around the Earth. Okay. This is my next to the last slide. I put this up here because not only is very little known about the work we're doing or the area of ocean renewable energy, in the area of the regulatory bodies, the stakeholders, that goes across both public, private, and governmental stakeholders, the whole network, the whole framework hasn't really been developed. It's evolving, and we've gotten a lot of good cooperation from the regulatory bodies. But you've got two regulatory bodies in the U.S. that are responsible for the two areas that I spoke about. The marine hydrokinetic, which is the force of the Gulf Stream, falls under BOEM, which is the Department of Interior. The ocean thermal energy conversion falls under NOAA as the lead agency. So you've got two different agencies. And the closer, if you're within the CZM area, that is FERC. So you've got different agencies. Once we have an application, and it's the first application for marine hydrokinetic lease under the interim policy in the United States for marine hydrokinetic. And so that's into BOEM now. They're conducting an environmental assessment. There should be a draft EA out for public view towards the end of December, beginning of January this year. What that is doing is the application that we submitted will start to lay the framework for future applicants, for industry, companies, others who want to do the research in the area. Okay, and hopefully this will give you an idea of the thing that requires a lease application is that mooring. That's what's driving the lease application. So any mooring of any system out in the OCS, whether it's wind power, whether it's marine hydrokinetic, from that standpoint, requires the lease. And we are in the process right now of, we've done a lot of work with our mooring and telemetry buoy. That will be out there stationary once we get the lease for the 5 years of the lease. That will be gathering not only information from the standpoint when we hook up a vessel and do testing of not only our initial device, but also the early stage devices for companies to do that evaluation and risk mitigation. But also, we will have a built-out system for oceanographic observation. This will start to give us a lot more information at the mesoscale and the local scale, which is needed to really fill out that map. And with that, thank you.
Okay, thanks, everyone. If I could have the panelists come back up. And you want to put the... Yeah, we'll share. We can share. Okay, so I would like to start with a question for maybe Igor and Chris. Igor, you put that beautiful picture, that beautiful slide up of all the different models that showed what would happen. Will the ocean conveyor stop? And concluded that. There was no agreement. There was no clear message out of all those models. But what do you here? Let's pass this down here. What do you think will happen? And maybe Chris, you want to jump in on that too, given what you know now.
Well, first of all, there is a message in that figure, because most models do predict that the conveyor belt will get weaker as in response to changing atmospheric conditions, to warming atmosphere and more precipitation and melting of sea ice. So that message is, so there is a consensus among models on this one. The models do not agree on the magnitude of the response. And in my opinion, we should probably wait until the model improves a little bit better before saying anything quantitative. But I would not be surprised if the conveyor belt is weakened by anything between 10% and 50%. I would not be surprised, but again, this is not a this is not an accurate prediction.
Yeah, as the observationalist who's actually looking at the data right now, I'd be even more cautious, I think, than Igor, saying that with the data we have right now, we're not seeing any indication whatsoever of a slowdown. What we are seeing is a huge amount of higher frequency variability that's going on all the time. So it's going to take us quite some time to be able to say that we're seeing any kind of a decrease. And the other thing is that the observing system is very much in its early stages for doing a lot of this monitoring. So I'm even more cautious, I think, than Igor in saying that this is too early to say that we're definitely going to see any kind of a major change.
Okay. Igor, did you want to add something to that?
Yes, just it also depends on what kind of time scale you're talking about. I was referring to a time scale of probably 100 years or so. And again, it depends on how long in the future you want to look at.
Okay, let's keep the microphone there for ease of answering questions. I also wondered a little bit, Chris, earlier on you showed about how with Harry Bryden's data where there was a fear that, yes, indeed, this ocean conveyor belt was slowing by as much as 30%, but that it was based on very little data. So I look at the data that you're collecting and hear you talking about being in the early stages of collecting that data, it does strike me a little bit that measuring ocean currents and trying to detect change and then make predictions based on that change is a little bit like taking wind and weather measurements across the United States and then trying to predict the weather, what the weather's going to be like in 10 years. And so I would like if you would just talk a little bit about how you deal with that problem of having such a huge system to measure and, you know, when how are we going to resolve this issue of collecting enough data to make predictions in the future? In 5 years, will we know enough? Or do we need more monitoring stations? How do we address that?
Yeah, I would say that we have a long way to go. We're definitely making progress. If you take as an example the El Nino phenomenon in the tropical Pacific that many of you are probably familiar with, they started trying to figure out what they would need to measure El Nino in the early 80s in terms of an observing system. And it was really only in the late 90s and early 2000s that the observing system was really kind of considered to be in a full form where they're able to say something. And, of course, at that point what they determined was long-term prediction was difficult, if not impossible, with El Nino. And so we're still at the stage now where we're going to get 6 to 9 months' notice of an El Nino happening. So the observing system helps, and it's giving you that information, but we're not going to be able to tell you 10 years down the road. For the meridional overturning circulation that we're talking about here, the timescales tend to be even longer. So the assumption is that it's going to potentially take us a decade or two to really get to the point where we're going to have an observing system that's going to be able to answer a lot of these questions. But if we don't start it now, then a decade or two from now, we still have nothing, and we're still at ground zero. So really we need, I think, to bite the bullet and start, you know, putting a lot of resources into this sort of a thing. We're measuring the MOC at one location now at 26.5 north here in the Atlantic. I think the scientific community has argued that we're going to need at least two more of these big arrays in the Atlantic, and then probably we're going to have to go down to the Southern Ocean where Igor was talking about. So we're going to talk about, if we really want to understand this, we're talking a couple of decades, and a significant amount of resources are going to have to put toward it as we go forward.
Okay, thanks. One more question over on this side of the table, so maybe we can send the microphone down. Nancy, you talked about how you're trying to take information that you're getting from the scientists on this side of the table and make decisions and plans for example, how Broward County will adapt to particularly sea level rise. So what I found myself wondering is, what happens if it happens a lot faster than than we predict?
Well, I think that's a great question. The first thing I would say is that you have to think about the temporal scales that are important to people. The temporal scale that's important to an elected official might be their term of office. So the question is, what's going to happen in 4 to 12 years' time? And that I need to make sure that I've put something in place in order to protect myself as an elected official. And I don't want to be quite that cynical, but the audience is, so I think I'm okay. But then you have to think about the timescales of public investment. And when you think about public investment and infrastructure, if I build a wastewater treatment plant, it has an estimated life. It's a 40-year life or a 50 years. If I build a road or a bridge, it has an estimated lifetime. And so I need to have a sense of understanding of what I should predict could happen so that that piece of infrastructure, that piece of public investment, will be maximized for what I'm intending to use it for. And so if I do nothing now and this happens much faster, it jeopardizes existing infrastructure, and then I don't have the infrastructure to sort of overcome some of those issues. So the word that I've heard a lot in our agency lexicon is no regrets strategy. So I build something and I say climate change is a possibility. There's a predicted linear change that I could extrapolate out that it's going to be a minimum of this much. So how much more money am I willing to spend to get an incremental benefit, and I won't regret that incremental benefit? And the no-regret strategy is one that's being employed more and more often. It's a conservative attitude about it's not an ostrich in the sand kind of attitude. It's, I recognize things are out there. I can't predict exactly what it's going to be. There's some uncertainty. But I'm going to recognize it's there, and I'm going to make an adjustment in order to put in the public infrastructure that's appropriate, but not regret that when it comes out 5 years later that the scientists were just kidding, that in fact, I've done the right thing for public investment.
Okay, I think, Sue, I'm going to wait on my question for you because I see that we have to be done at 3:15. So I'm going to open it up now to the audience, and can we start over here?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, how do you address these questions? How did you get to the point where you can make this regional?
The Regional Climate Compact was formed because there were elected officials in each of the four counties that were willing to step out and act as champions of the cause. That being said, they had very good staff behind them who were willing to adjust their work plans to take on that cause and do the day-to-day work to make it happen. One of the things that was recognized based on the timing of when the compact was formed was that both at the national and international level, that climate policy was failing, that they were, what strides had been made early on were falling back, and that what we had hoped to get from the national and international policies weren't there. And that we can't, as a local entity, ignore the fact that there are things happening here. Because climate change, you talk about mitigation of greenhouse gases, and you talk about adaptation to the impacts that are going to happen whether we are able to mitigate or not, such as sea level rise. And so all adaptation is local, and recognizing that we will be impacted whether there's national or international policy or not drives the elected officials locally to say, we must take action. This is happening to us. It's happening to us now.
Other questions? Over here.
Yes, Heather Dewar. I'm a freelance journalist. And I recognize that the conveyor belt, potential changes in the conveyor belt that you two, Igor and Chris, are talking about could have significant implications for the work that Nancy and Susan are doing. But it's not exactly clear to me what the cause and effect relationship might be between the conveyor belt slowing and local sea level, the rate of local sea level rise and the rate of exchange between the deep ocean and the surface. But Susan, can you guys throw out some potential answer to that question?
All right.
Did my question make sense?
I'm trying to think if I can rephrase it. Do you guys want to try to? All right, here. Oh, you need a microphone.
Give me the one.
Oh, sorry, this has been a. Actually, we might be able to take it out of the stand. That's all right.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm still
going to do that while you talk.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Well, if I understood your question correctly, you're referring to the link between the regional impacts of climate change in Florida. South Florida, and changes in the conveyor belt,
yes.
If there is a connection. Speaking about the sea level rise, as it turns out, the changes in the circulation itself affect sea level rise. Because when the water moves, there is an associated change in the sea level. That is, the surface of the ocean cannot be flat if the water moves. So when the speed of the current changes, the sea level will change as well. So there is a connection between the speed of the current, Florida current, and the sea level next to Florida, even if you ignore all the thermal effects that we were referring to. So there is a connection. In addition, if many models show a significant response of the climate as a whole to changes in the strength of the conveyor belt, for example, if the conveyor belt is completely destroyed or shut down, one can expect global changes in precipitation patterns, in temperature distribution. There is, in one study, just to give an example of how globally interconnected these climate parts of the climate system are, one study is showing that if you shut down the conveyor belt, the Indian monsoons will become less frequent. It's not an obvious connection, but the model does show a robust mechanism for this kind of link. So the climate system is a very complicated body with a lot of important links.
Just to clarify, when the current slows down, would sea level then rise in this area
as
the current slows? What would the direction of the trend be?
The question is, what will happen to the sea level as the current slows down? This is not may not be a very easy question to answer. But one thing for sure, that if the current does not move, the surface would be nearly flat, flatter at least than it is now, and therefore the sea level would be changed. But that depends a lot on not only on the current movement, but also on the temperature of the current and distribution of temperature in the ocean as well.
Okay, and you asked if there would be an effect locally, and since our planning horizons are about 20 to 50 years, and this seems to be if it's happening at all, which is not clear, if it does happen, it'll happen on probably longer timelines. So it's less likely that we would need to take it into concern for our immediate planning activities.
I'm just going to take a little bit of a different tact, because what we're doing is to provide the basis and the capability for companies to come in and test their small-scale devices before they translate those into fully commercial capabilities. And so the importance of the profile of the current, where the strong spot is for the devices or for the speed, is important. And so sustainability is one of the real key factors, both in the ocean current speed, but also in the thermal exchange. If you start seeing a heat up in the oceans and that delta T is diminished, then the investment isn't going to be there. The companies that are going to do the investing, the venture capitalists, are going to look at that and say, you know, this is really not sustainable, or it's only sustainable for maybe a prediction of, you know, 10 years or whatever. So it's important that we get not only the macro level modeling and simulation and get the data to incorporate in that to verify those models, but then be able to start thinking about the prediction for long-term feasibility. Over here.
This is a question for Nancy, and it may be premature to actually offer some specific examples of things that you are already undertaking, but maybe you can, and if not, do you have any that you are very seriously considering now? A few examples of the kinds of ways that you're adapting to what's coming.
Okay, could you just identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm very sorry. I'm Tom Yulesman. I'm a freelance journalist and also co-director of the Center for Environmental Journalism.
All right, Tom. I believe your question is, is there any adaptation infrastructure going on now, or are we already doing things to deal with these issues?
And if not, things that you are seriously considering right now that are coming?
Adaptation happens all the time to sea level rise, but it's hidden in people making they call it something else. They don't necessarily call it adaptation to sea level rise. For example, in the city of Hollywood, they had an area called the Lakes that was flooding on a regular basis when they had heavy rains. So they installed some stormwater pumps. Those stormwater pumps can serve the same function when they have extreme high tides. And so that's an example. There was an area in downtown Miami where a street was flooding regularly at high tide, and so they raised the road. Now, they didn't call it adaptation to sea level rise. They called it stormwater management or road maintenance, but in fact, that's what they were doing. And so those kinds of activities are going on. The areas that I was showing of tidal flooding in the city of Fort Lauderdale, they have retrofitted some of those storm drains with one-way valves so that the storm water can go out, but the seawater cannot come in. And they are testing those to see if that can provide for an extension of the life of the properties that are there. Long-term adaptation is going to require a whole toolbox of different kinds of activities. We're going to have to change our comprehensive plans to consider climate change or aspects of climate change, whether we call it that or not. The language has to be there to provide for the ability to have a climate resilient community. We're going to have to change, or we're going to have to strongly consider making changes in land use to prevent people from investing or reinvesting in areas that get damaged because of sea level rise. And an example that probably hits home with a lot of people is in Katrina came in and it destroyed a lot of areas, and the first response of the community is, we are resilient, we will build again, and we'll build in the same places that have the same problems that they have in the future, but instead we'll put our homes up on 12-foot stilts. Now, that works in terms of building resiliency, but of the 20 houses that might have come back into a neighborhood, there are two. And so we have to ask ourselves, when we have post-disaster type planning, are we going to rebuild in those locations that we've already identified as vulnerable to the effects of sea level rise and related impacts? So I think that's one of the areas that we need to think about very carefully, is starting to create a culture within our regulatory system, within our comprehensive planning system, that allows for considering sea level rise, considering climate issues as part of that longer-term planning.
More questions?
I'm Mary Catherine O'Connor, an independent journalist. I have a question for Susan Scamp. The hydrokinetic marine work that your group is doing, what is the transmission scenario for that energy that you made?
Right now, and the question was, what is the transmission scenario for MHK, the work we're doing? Right now, for this first mooring system and the system testing, it will not be transmitted to shore. That would require a greater level of evaluation. It's called an EIS, you know, impact statement, thank you, rather than an environmental assessment. So it would require much more. And it's in an area where we're testing is actually within the CHAPC, that habitat, but the area that we will be doing the, I wish I had the map back up, the three blocks or the 27 square miles are in an area that has already shown to be of a bottom that does not have a preponderance of the corals at all. Okay, very little that we've seen. So to answer your question, the first part, the first testing, the heat is actually going to be used on the surface, on the with the systems on the surface for the data management, and also dissipated as heat. Okay.
And then if those tests were successful and we found it a viable way of producing energy,
then eventually we would, as a university, we are. I'm sorry. Thank you. Eventually, what would we do in the way of transmission of that electricity? As a university, we are not in the business of energy for a profit. We would bring in about 5 megawatts, possibly in through the Port Everglades area. There's also the John U. Lloyd State Park, which is trying to go strictly off the grid, and so we're looking at different options in that respect, but we need to. There's also the Navy station down there, the South Florida Ocean Management System, and there are ways that we're already looking at where they have cable laid out there and using that footprint possibly lay a line along that system. Further reduction in the environment.
Susan, I'm going to take my moderator's prerogative and ask you, I haven't heard any numbers in terms of like what how does this compare in terms of cost to either other alternate, you know, renewable energy sources? Are we that far along yet? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I don't think we're that far along, and it's actually going to depend on the distance. It's going to depend on the network of the transmission. It's going to depend on the type of device and how much, and I'm talking about commercially, how much production can be per device, but also the efficiency of the device, and then what an array is going to look like. And part of the work we're doing right now is the investigation of how would you site an array? What's the distance of the upstream, downstream of these devices, and also east to west? And is there a potential of being able to take advantage of what would happen once you get a flow of water through a device? And these can be what you think of as the windmills that you see. It can be a different type of a device. It can be a shrouded device. They're all different devices right now. It's early, like you would see in the aerospace industry or even in the wind power generation. Lots of. So it's too early to tell, but we are doing the investigation of the arrays, and that'll start giving us a better feeling of it. And just one more point. We've already been working with over 36 companies through confidential disclosure agreements on what their early devices are going to look like, or even companies that are looking more in the O&M side of things and also in the oceanographic instruments, the newer instruments that are needed that I think Chris alluded to, too.
Other questions? I think we have time for one more question. Anybody?
Like that, or is it too soon to tell at this point?
It's a very good question, and the question is, what are the effects for the marine life of having ocean renewable energy or marine hydrokinetic systems? There's a lot of work ongoing now, and I think some of the sessions are even talking about, you know, fish habitat, marine life. We're doing aerial investigations to understand, as I mentioned before, the distribution and the directionality of just the migratory patterns of both sea turtles and the larger marine mammals. Doing work on, you know, there's going to be a cause and effect because some of the marine life, such as plankton, et cetera, might actually foul up the systems. So we need to understand that. So there's a lot of ongoing work between not only ourselves and the other two centers, national centers, but worldwide, including with Brazil. And Brazil has a potential, significant potential, that they're for marine renewable energy in many different forms. So I hope that answers your question. But keep your eyes on what the centers are putting out in the way of information and the sharing of information with the agencies and the scientists in the agencies and the laboratories, because this is all public information except where a company comes along, wants us to do a specific thing, and they pay for it. That's where the difference is.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap up here. Before everyone leaves, I would ask you to think about when you get your little SEJ questionnaire that says, how did you enjoy the conference? Would you suggest any changes to the session? So think now, jot down any thoughts you might have now about this session, any recommendations you might have for improvements to how we're doing the conference for the future. And I also want to remind you that at 3:30 we're going to have Sylvia Earle in the Grand Ballroom along with Ken Salazar as in open to questions and to give a presentation. So, of course, we'd love to see you all there. And I'd like to thank my panelists and encourage you to contact them. Thanks very much.